Well, thank you very much. That certainly was a fine array of presentations, and they stayed within the 20-minute limit with clear consistency. Now we will entertain questions, and if you'd identify yourself and your affiliation. I should note that this is all being taped. That's just a heads up, because this will be playing on iPods across the world in a week or so. So people want to know who's asking the question and where they're from. Go ahead.
Imitation of self-censorship, it sounds like. Steve Hayward, American Enterprise Institute. A question for Professor Arnhart with an invitation for Professor West to comment. Professor, I haven't read your two books on this, so perhaps this question is miscast, but here it is anyway. This morning, every time you said Darwin or Darwinism this morning, what seemed to follow in the sequel sounded to me like Aristotle. And so I'm wondering if I'm to escape the conclusion that your project isn't making Darwin into a footnote of Aristotle, maybe this question. Can you point to some kind of evolutionary change in the last 5,000 years that constitutes a substantive change in human nature? Does
Go
that
ahead.
Make sense? Or
I don't know if your mic's on.
To the last question, no. Or the evolutionary change in human nature over the past 5,000 years. And that your observation is astute as far as suggesting a kind of Aristotelian reading of Darwin. Actually, years ago, when I first got it started in this kind of thinking, was from reading Aristotle and realizing, he's a biologist. He's about a quarter of all of the surviving writings of Aristotle are biology. And so I got interested in the connection between Aristotle's biology and his moral political philosophy, which then led me into the Darwinian studies to see if there was any compatibility between those two biological traditions, which I think there are. Now, granted, you can't find an evolutionary conception of the emergence of life in Aristotle, but there are remarkable comparisons insofar as Aristotle's account of the biological nature of social and political animals, how human beings represent a certain strand of social political behavior that's comparable to that of other animals. I mean, that kind of thinking and of natural right or natural law as potentially rooted in some biological conception of human nature, I think, is common to Aristotle and Darwin, though I know that's a controversial point.
Professor West, do you want
to? I would just say that I think that as I said, the Darwinian theory is really against any sort of essentialism of the sort that you might find in Aristotle, of the forms being things that really wouldn't be, that are permanent or an intrinsic. Kind of think about that. Today, about the last 5,000 years, it seems to me that in a Darwinian approach, I highlight this in my talk, anything that has persisted in nature over the past 5,000 years is hard to not provide the same sort of justification that Dr. Arnhart provides for things like the maternal instinct. Well, rape has existed in a lot of different societies for a long time. You find certain pockets of even things like incest that you would think biologically wouldn't make any sense. Sexual patterns, this was the whole Kinsey approach, which actually owes itself to Darwinism. He was an evolutionary biologist by training, started studying gall wasps, and his approach to studying human sexuality, well, if some sort of action, whether it be adultery or sodomy or something, if you could find it in nature, and if you can find a pattern persisting over time, then that was, in some sense, just as biologically natural, and that was normal mammalian behavior. And I think that in a Darwinian sense, you have a really tough time not justifying seeing things like the maternal instinct, but actually criticizing other things. I think where you really see this in Dr. Arnhart's work is in Darwinian conservatism when he deals with psychopaths and the inability to actually hold them morally blameworthy because, in fact, they're programmed to be psychopaths, so that's, we can kill them because they would threaten our survival, but we can't really morally blame them.
Let me just add something here that, you know, in some ways, I think there may be more agreement between John and I than it might appear on the surface. As was intimated in John's comments and just briefly, maybe towards the end of mine, John does agree that it might be very helpful for conservative social thought to be able to appeal to a biological human nature. After all, we do it all the time. When we talk about sex differences, we talk about family life, we talk about natural inclinations and how those inclinations shape and structure, or should shape and structure, moral judgment and social policy and so on, even though they don't determine them. And on that, we're in agreement. Now, the disagreement is the ultimate causes of that biological human nature. And John would say, well, we need some conception of intelligent design, whereas I would say it can be explained in terms of Darwinian evolution. But at least there is that agreement at the level of biological nature as potentially being important for our discussions.
Dr. Peterson, you have any thoughts on this?
That we have a biological nature, and that can be helpful to appeal to it as part of the terrain, as part of the situation we face. I think that's quite useful. But I think there might also be substantial agreement that you can hear underneath here too, that it's not simply enough to say that there is a biological tendency. We're simply going to have to bring other things to the table to think through what's right and good and healthy, who we want to be and what we want to do. So there's a difference between describing what we start with and prescribing who and what we should be. I think that's a key distinction.
Yes. Next.
Mark Kultoff, Hillsdale College. My question, I think, is mostly for Drs. Arnhart and West. I wonder if we can find some common ground by suggesting that you might be talking past one another and beating up on straw men. Dr. West understands rightly that Darwin and Darwinism seems to be dysteleological, godless, purposeless atheism, and he doesn't like that. I think most conservatives don't, at least at some level, are philosophical theists or committed to some kind of theism of the Judeo-Christian tradition. Dr. Arnhart seems to be opposed to young earth creationism, 6 24-hour days, flood geology, and God of the gaps theology of intelligent design. Is there a via media here by which one might embrace the kind of thing that is commonly called theistic evolution, which Darwin said is not Darwinism, because when Asa Gray proposed it to him in the 19th century, Asa Gray said, I'll embrace evolution, but I think God has a hand in it. Today we have people like Stephen Barr. In between, there were people like B.B. Warfield. Is there some room for a kind of evolutionary hypothesis that still embraces a robust philosophical or Western theism that doesn't have to embrace either God of the gaps or biblical literalism, but doesn't have to wrap their arms around a Charles Darwin who is dysteleological and atheistic?
Professor West, do you want to?
I'd say yes, and I think properly considered, even intelligent design is not anti-evolution and certainly wouldn't rule out various forms of evolution, but I think that it's very important in current debates that we define our terms of what we mean, because most of the public debates and even some of the intellectual debates don't define terms properly. So, and theistic evolution is one of those terms that can mean almost anything, to anyone. The people say who are evolutionary biologists, say like Ken Miller, who claims that he's an Orthodox Catholic and an Orthodox Darwinian. If you really probe by what they mean, their form of theistic evolution is at best a justification for an uncaused cause, a very deistic notion that I think is frankly hard to square with traditional Judeo-Christian theism. For example, Ken Miller, who I just interacted with a few weeks ago in New Hampshire for two 90-minute sessions, says in his book, Finding Darwin's God, that he agrees with Stephen Jay Gould, the late Stephen Jay Gould, that if you rewound the history of life and played it over again, you get things completely different. And that in his view, God's role was he set up this undirected process that he knew that was undirected, but it could do wonderful things that would produce something that was rational. As he said in this meeting in New Hampshire that I was with him a few weeks ago, it could have been a dinosaur with a big brain or a thinking mollusk. And that's his view of God's role. Now, I'm a Protestant, not a Catholic, but I will leave you those who are Catholics, if that's Orthodox Catholicism. I don't think so. I don't think it's Orthodoxy or Protestantism or Catholicism. So I do think that there are forms of directed or teleological evolution. Darwinism ain't it.
Well, I do agree that it's possible to defend some kind of theistic evolution that would be compatible with almost everything that I say for Darwinian conservatism. And actually, if you look at the criticisms of my position from Peter Lawler and Carson Holloway, who are both conservative Catholics, they adopt the John Paul II position, where evolution in general can be accepted as compatible with the tradition of Christianity, but the emergence of the human soul shows an ontological leap that indicates some miraculous intervention of the creator or the intelligent designer. And so with that sort of modification, one could accept a certain theistic evolution that might accept a lot of the moral political teaching of Darwinism, but against the background of theistic creationism, which gives a kind of cosmic teleology to this conception, which is not there in Darwin, granted, but which I think is not incompatible with an evolutionary conception.
I see you're writing some notes there.
If I may. Yeah, if I could respond to the charge of deism. One possibility is to argue that God ordains and controls everything. So you have books like R.C. Sproul, Not a Chance, that there is nothing which happens by chance. God controls everything in every detail. So God decides that particular cell dies, this particular cell moves over 2 microns. God controls everything by choice. You could also argue that God starts a system and allows it to continue. And sometimes people argue that that second is deistic, that God is absent. If there's a position in between that's sometimes called punctuated equilibrium, that there's a natural course which God has put into place, which is developing, and then God adjusts, God intervenes on occasion to make it go the way God wishes it to go. In between those interventions, God is still aware and God is still involved, not absent, even if God is not controlling every detail. So the discussion becomes not whether God is aware, not whether God is involved, but how often God chooses to intervene to get the process started and allows it to develop in the way that it's been fully gifted and intended, or whether God is controlling every detail or something in between. I think most theistic evolutionists are arguing that God is doing something in between and would not accept that that's being deistic, that just because God isn't guiding every detail doesn't mean that God is absent or unaware or uninvolved.
But would you agree with Ken Miller that human beings are sort of the detail then? I mean, it seems to me that when you're talking about whether God intended human beings, that's not a deep detail or a happenstance of history. That's a pretty big event.
I would agree theologically, speaking as a theologian, that God intended to create human beings to be fit for fellowship with Him. That's part of the ultimate intent of what God is doing, speaking from the Christian tradition. As to how crucial it is for bearing God's image or having a relationship with God, how crucial a particular physical form is, I don't know that that's actually addressed in traditional theology or scripture, for that matter.
A thinking mollusk?
Okay. Well, it's hard to picture a thinking mollusk because by definition, solitary, isolated, cut off from others, how could that be one who has an individual with a relationship with God and with others? So I think that's a bizarre.
We could perhaps get off the edge. Bizarre here with our next question.
This is David Forte from Cleveland State University. This question is to Professor Peterson. First, my compliments on one of the most elegant renditions of Darwinist theories I've ever heard. From your position, which holds that genes present a pattern or a predisposition, but do not dictate our choice what to do about them, I have two questions. One is, in your opinion, whence comes this capacity for choice? And two, is there anything in your understanding of biological theory that would account for a nature which might inform the appropriate use of that choice?
Human beings are immensely complex. I think probably the quickest approach to the question of do we have freedom of choice is that we all, I think, have an experience of choosing. Now, at what deep level, how are our choices affected, and how do we define free will? To what degree are we shaped by our environment, by our genes, by the choices that we've made most recently? It's immensely complex, and I wouldn't presume to try to parse all that out. The fact that we experience choice is an emergent phenomenon, I would argue, that as we have many biological systems, that as they develop, they start to come to a level of complexity where more is happening than happened before. That's just as real, that cannot be fully explained by the earlier description. Let me give you just a very concrete, quick example from the sciences. You've probably heard someone talk about the theory of everything as a physicist, where what they're actually looking at is not a theory of how everything in the world that is real happens. They're trying to understand particle physics. That's at a very basic level. But along comes a biochemist and says, or actually along comes a chemist and says, when you start to talk about a molecule, you can't describe it purely in terms of particle physics. There's more to it than that. And then a biochemist comes along and says, well, that glucose you're looking at is not just a chemical, it's part of a biochemical process. And then a physiologist says, well, actually, what you've described is real and true, but it happens to be part of a release of energy, of ATP. That's crucial to the reality, the complexity that emerges of what's actually happening. Then the next person says, well, it's attached to a vocal cord. The next person says it's neurological because the brain is ordering it. And the next person says, well, actually, the person is singing, so this is a matter of music at a level of complexity. The next person says, well, they're singing in a chorus of the Messiah, so it's sociology, they're singing with their friends. It's economics, they're doing it for pay. And it's theological, they're doing it as a matter of worship. Now, at each of those emergent levels, there is more which is real, it's part of reality, that can't be fully described by the constituent parts at the lower levels. And we see that in science. I think it extends all the way up through the highest levels of complexity and discussion. When we start talking about humans making choices, about God being involved, about our relationship with God. So evolution, if you try to reduce it to purely a physical phenomenon, does not describe the reality we experience and know to be the case. But you can talk about emerging properties as you increase levels of complexity. That's some of my immediate reaction. I'm not sure if I'm addressing precisely what you had in mind or not, and you've moved away from the microphone. Do you want to come back to any of that in particular?
Well, I think that's a great answer, although it wasn't to my question.
Ah, sorry. I'm glad it was fruitful.
Perhaps the next question will be to his answer.
Perhaps Professor Peterson's last remark suggests he has a future in politics.
Can you identify yourself, please?
I'm Philip Hughes from the White House Writers Group, and I have a question for Dr. Arnhart that draws on promptings or observations from all three panelists. Professor West's citation of that startling passage from The Descent of Man about what if human beings lived like bees in a beehive, and might they adopt for survival a radically different morality dictated by their living circumstances as essential for survival, prompted me to think about an experience we've actually had of this, I think, in the 20th century. In the period of fascism, there actually was a rhetorical justification for radically alternative morality, practices that most of us would consider barbaric, that were justified in part on a not explicitly Darwinian, but a claim of what was essential for racial or national survival and thriving. Now, most of us, people at the time and now, would look at those claims of, you know, what was necessary for survival as a justification for a radically alternative morality as specious. It's just not really objectively necessary at all. And probably Darwinian defenders would say, well, that was just a misuse or misapplication of sort of Darwinian reasoning. But how, within the logic of Darwinian reasoning, can you tell the difference between some circumstance, some condition of living that would justify a radically different, maybe we'd consider barbaric or inhuman, morality essential for survival from just a misappropriation or misapplication of that justification for other ulterior purposes.
Professor Arnard?
Well, I would see. I would agree with that passage from Darwin that if we were social insects or bees specifically, we would have a different nature, different needs, and so the good for us would be different from what it is when we're human beings. But the point is that each species has its own nature, and what is good for one species is not good for another. Actually, Thomas Aquinas said the same thing: what's good for a dog is not the same as what is good for a horse or a human being. There's a comment that E.O. Wilson once made about Marxism. He said, good theory, wrong species. And he's a myrmecologist, an expert in ants, and he said, yeah, I've seen Marxism at work, and these social insects. But it's the wrong species, you know? You can't do it for human beings. You could do it for social insects. Aldous Huxley said that his Brave New World was an attempt to portray what human beings would look like if they really were just like social insects. But of course, the answer is we're not social insects. So that kind of utopian scheming is not going to work for us. But it points to, you know, the problem that people like John and others have with this, that since there isn't this cosmic teleology in Darwinism, that is, the good for human beings is contingent upon the fact that we emerged, and here we are, and we have a nature, and some things are good for us, and some things are not. And for the Darwinian, that isn't necessarily the product of any cosmic purposefulness, which is where the theistic evolutionist would want to introduce some cosmic purposefulness, as opposed to just the immanent purposefulness that if you have a species that has a nature and so has certain inherent ends or purposes intrinsic to that nature.
I'm sorry, but I think that passage, that's putting a happy face on the passage. It's part of a section of The Descent of Man where he's going through all sorts of horrible things that happen and trying to make the argument that, well, in some of those situations, those were dictated by survival. And even this bee passage, he's not saying we have an intrinsic, that we're intrinsically not like bees. He says, if men were reared under precisely the same conditions as hive bees, so the same environmental conditions, then our nature suddenly would become something different to kill our, you know, female children and sacred duty to kill their brothers. On this whole idea you bring out, I think it's exactly right. It's not that you can't justify some forms of goodness in Darwinism, it's that you're undercutting the ways of actually criticizing, you know, following the law of natural selection and the whole eugenics practice. It wasn't just in Nazi Germany, it was for four decades in America. All the leading evolutionary biologists, not just a few, thought it was a rational deduction. I think it was. I don't think it was a necessarily deduction, but it was a rational deduction because of Darwin himself wrote things like this in Descent of Man. With savages, the weakened body or mind are soon eliminated. We civilized men, on the other hand, do our utmost to check the process of elimination. And he goes talking about building asylums for the insane, the maimed, the sick, welfare laws. We inoculate people against smallpox. Thus, the weak members of civilized societies propagate their kind. No one who has attended to the breeding of domestic animals will doubt that this must be highly injurious to the race of man. Hardly anyone is so ignorant as to allow his worst animals to breed. Now, Darwin does go on to say, you know, our natural sense of compassion doesn't allow us to follow the dictates of reason. But once you but to say that someone else who follows the dictates of reason that Darwin himself lays out is twisting Darwin, I think, is a real stretch. Darwin, the proper Victorian, was squeamish, I will admit, about some of the implications of his theory, but he laid them out in The Descent of Man, which I'd encourage everyone to read.
Professor Peterson, you got any? We're running out of time here. I would work one more question if you got.
Follow up that again, I think a key from my understanding would be that even if you accept an evolutionary description of how we come to be, that's different from prescribing that that's what we should continue to do on to the into the future. And that's a key distinction I would like to come back to. All right.
Okay, this is the last question. I'm sorry, we have to.
All right, my name is Keith Miller. I'm a law student at Columbia University in New York City, where William James Bryan at Columbia delivered his lectures very critical of evolution. So I want to ask Dr. Arnhart, maybe in defense of William Jennings Bryan and his progeny, as Professor West indicated, one of the things that current conservative opponents of Darwin are accused of is waging a war on science. Are you, in telling conservatives to leave William Jennings Bryan and join Charles Darwin, are you saying we should lay down arms in this war? Are there questions that we shouldn't ask? You cited Patrick Henry College questioning the orthodoxy of evolution. Those are the same people who would question the orthodoxy of global warming. Should they just say, oh, scientists, go ahead, do your thing? Or can they continue to press their political preferences?
Go ahead.
Well, as I've indicated, I actually agree with John as far as being quite open to the discussion of the difficulties with Darwinian theory. I don't see anything wrong with having high school students in their biology classes look at the sort of problems that John and the intelligent sign people raise. So in that point, I get into trouble with the Darwinians who think this is going back to the Dark Ages to even open up for discussion, because I think that a lot of the objections raised by the ID people turn out to be the very same difficulties that Darwin himself indicated, that he understood there were these problems. And I think students can learn a lot about scientific argumentation and reasoning if they're actually allowed to discuss this debate, weigh the arguments and the evidence, and decide for themselves, you know, what the weight of the evidence and arguments points to, than to just be given a textbook version of science. In fact, I do that myself with undergraduates when I teach, and I find that they're often excited to be able to actually talk about these issues in a way that they can't do in their biology classes. So I would think conservatives should be open to that kind of a broad discussion of science, which includes raising serious questions.
Okay. I think we'll have to call it to a close here. I want to thank this panel for their